In the Civil Rights Act of 1968, America does move forward. And the bell of freedom rings out a little louder.
This is A Little Louder, a podcast for wonks, housers, and rabble-rousers, where we talk about fair housing, community development, and how we can use these issues to build people power and work toward equity and justice. I'm John Hinneberger.
And I'm Elizabeth Ream.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, John.
How you doing?
Doing well. Good to see you today.
For those of our listeners may remember, Elizabeth's been on the podcast before. Elizabeth is an attorney at Texas Housers and specializes in all things to do with the low-income housing tax credit program and the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs that implements that program.
Good thing I love acronyms, because all these things I deal with have incredibly long names.
This is not an episode where we're going to go into the depths of the low-income housing tax credit program. Elizabeth and I did that in a previous episode a while back, so you can go back if you want to learn just how the low-income housing tax credit program works and what it is. We're here today to talk about some current issues with the program and to talk about some pet peeves that Elizabeth and I have about the way that this program operates. Elizabeth, let's dive right into it. Maybe we ought to give our listeners like a 30-second explanation of what that program actually is.
Absolutely. So the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program is a federal program. I'll call it LIHTC for short. So it's an indirect federal subsidy to finance construction and rehabilitation of low-income rental housing. It's a massive subsidy the state of Texas hands out to the tune of a little more than $80 million per year in low-income housing tax credits. And it's a federal program, but it's administered at the state level.
That federal program is not administered by HUD, but administered by the Department of the Treasury under a set of general rules about how the program works.
Exactly. Yeah, it's under the Internal Revenue Code. Because these are tax credits, it's all run through the Treasury. And there are some rules to the program, obviously, but they're fairly brief. At the federal level, they have 10 selection criteria that are general, and then a few required preferences for applications in order to choose which projects get awarded the low-income housing tax credits. And then it's up to the state to really determine all the nitty-gritty of how that works and what that looks like. And it really, really varies state to state. Texas, the state legislature has actually made a lot of laws that dictate how the tax credits can be handed out within the state. And so then the state agency, TDHCA, has to incorporate the federal rules and the state legislature rules. And then they have their own really lengthy document that's the allocation plan that determines how they hand out the tax credit. So there are many layers here, many, many layers.
We're here today to talk primarily about what the State Department of Housing and Community Affairs, what that layer does with the tax credit program. We have a number of bones to pick probably about the rules that the Texas legislature's created for this program. But again, we're going to defer our complaints about what the state legislature does to another program. And we're going to talk actually a little bit about how does the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs go about making the rules?
These rules come out in the Texas Administrative Code. TDHCA every year updates those rules. So they're, you know, each year coming in with their starting point of the existing rules, and it's on an annual cycle of update that's dictated by the state legislature. And so each year, TDHCA as a staff looks at the rules, makes suggested changes in a draft that they then publish in the Texas Register for public comment. They have a written comment period, and then the staff gives specific written responses to each comment that they get, which is very satisfying to see as an advocate that they read your comments and wrote back. Then they either incorporate changes that were suggested or state that they're not doing so. And then the allocation plan draft of the admin code goes to the governor. And the governor can throw in a wild card if he wants to or change anything that he would like. It typically doesn't happen, or just minor things happen at that phase. And then it becomes the rule for the following year.
And who influences this process, Elizabeth? Who's typically in the room when the hearings are held and when the decisions are made?
It's an open public process in theory, but in reality, I mean, I've never seen a tenant present there. That's one thing that we're working on at Hauser's, figuring out how to get tenants involved. But these decisions are really made by TDHCA staff that are looking at overarching policy. They receive a ton of comments from developers and the affordable housing industry groups. Texas Housers gives comments and a couple of other advocacy organizations. But definitely when you're in these hearings and when you're looking at the written comments, the vast majority that you're seeing are from the development community, those companies that are working on affordable housing.
We've just finished the process of getting these public comments, and the board of directors appointed by the governor of the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs has voted on the new rules for how the tax credit program will be governed. What's bugging us about the decisions that the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs Board made on tax credits this year?
Oh, good. I was going to dive into what was bugging me right away anyways, even if you didn't bring it up. Process-wise, what's bugging me is for the past couple of years, TDHCA has had the written comment period, but there's really no meaningful opportunity for engagement on general issues about the allocation process. They've just had the written comment period. And then, you know, this last cycle, for example, almost all of my comments that I would have liked to see, they said that the change would require additional public comment and more time, essentially, in order to make such a substantive change. But they didn't really create that opportunity this year.
They basically said, thanks for your ideas, but we're not really ready to take up any of that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, not this year, they seem to say. But on the good side, it looks like they are interested in having a couple of drafts, an informal comment period next year, as well as the formal comment period, and having an open period, maybe even beginning in January, to start taking comments. So we're really going to prepare this year and make sure that we're giving all of our input up front. It is definitely a complaint from the past 2 years, and it looks like TDHCA is moving in the right direction on that and receiving, in creating more of an opportunity to receive and have time to act on comments.
Next year may be the important year that they might consider some more structural changes to the program that we think are overdue.
That's what we're hoping. Yes. Texas Housers has had some success in the past on these things, on some topics that maybe are coming up next year. So coming up next year, TDHCA is definitely going to be hearing our voices, Texas Housers and other advocates, but they'll also be hearing from the developers who consistently are, many of them are consistently pushing for cheaper sites and places that they can build that work well for their bottom line, but aren't necessarily where we'd like to see affordable housing being built. At Hauser's, we're always looking at choice and looking for tenants having the opportunity to live in whatever area they'd like to live in. And one way that we look at that is whether it's a high opportunity area, whether there are good schools, whether it's close to grocery stores and parks and all these things. And so that'll be one area that we'll be pushing on next year. There's a part of the allocation plan of those TDHCA allocation rules called the Opportunity Index. And in my opinion, it should be worth many, many more points. It should be weighted much more heavily. And also the amenities should be pulled out a little differently so that the ones that are really, really important to people are what are kind of moving to the top, moving projects to the top of the list, because it is a very competitive process.
By opportunity index, that's Hauser speak for, is the property in an environmentally safe area? Is it near jobs and good schools and a grocery store and stuff that people need who are tenants? Is that right?
Exactly. That's right. And schools are included in the opportunity index, and schools are also included elsewhere in the allocation plan, but that has fallen by the wayside since the pandemic began. Very unfortunately, TDHCA has followed the desire of some people in the development community, who some of whom would really prefer to get rid of schools in the allocation plan entirely. So TDHCA in the past couple of years has just kind of waived a lot of the school requirements because of the pandemic, because the Texas Education Agency isn't actively grading schools the past couple of years. But I argue that, if I were trying to choose where to live with my high school student, my high school child, I probably wouldn't want to be near a school that was failing the past 2 years that it was rated. So we're really hoping that we can get TDHCA to take that more seriously, because that really is such an important thing when you're thinking about where these low-income housing projects are built, where these affordable housing projects are built.
The tension is between the developer's interest to minimize the cost of land, to be able to find inexpensive sites, and the tenant's need to want to live in a good place. The question before the state is, how do you balance out those two different competing interests?
Exactly. And I mean, the developers do honestly have it pretty hard in some ways, in that they have the additional problem of, you know, wherever they want to site something, they have to have the proper zoning, which often involves getting the proper zoning if it's not there already, and then also convincing the neighbors to allow it in. And so that's a perpetual problem with siting these properties. You look at a city like Austin, and you can see that in wealthier areas, you don't see low-income housing tax credit properties. A large part of that is just that that the local homeowners and the local community won't allow it, won't allow their local politicians to allow it. So that is a big piece that they come up against. But I believe that, you know, there is so much money involved. There's so much money on the table. These tax credits are so competitive that I think that if TDHCA pushed developers through the rules, then they would be more willing to find a way, versus if TDHCA allows them to keep building in the same areas where they've been building, then that's just going to continue because there's not the pressure on developers. And there are some deconcentration factors and types of things that are meant to kind of spread out low-income housing tax credit properties geographically. And they have some, they certainly have a lot of utility, but they aren't enough to push things into these really high opportunity areas.
The high costs of the tax credit program to the taxpayer is something we talked about in the last time we talked. Elizabeth, we're also concerned about trying to make sure that these low-income housing tax credit apartments are, at least some of them, are available to poor people and the elderly and people with disabilities and the like.
Certainly. And from the federal rules on down, there are requirements about the level of affordability and income targeting at low-income housing tax credit properties. And that is the purpose of the program. But one of my largest complaints with the program is there's not deep enough income targeting, and it's really not reaching the area with the highest needs of people with extremely low incomes, which is usually, which is defined as below 30% of AMI, of area median income. So really looking at people making in the very lowest income brackets. And I think that the more that TDHCA can hone their rules to create housing, create a higher number of units and a higher proportion of the units within each project to target that extremely low income population, the better off we will all be in all of our communities. So that's something that we're hoping to push for more in the future.
The third bone we need to pick has to do with making sure that the apartments are well maintained. And we've certainly seen ample evidence of properties that have received low-income housing tax credit developments not be maintained by the owners. What's the role of the state in making sure that maintenance happens?
And this is an area of such frustration to me and all of us here at Housers, is that, you know, many of these properties are well maintained, but there are some that are in such abysmal condition that it's just pretty unbelievable. With TDHCA devoting so many resources, so much staff to compliance and monitoring and all of these things, it really feels like a broken kind of system at the state level if they're not able to enforce any type of maintenance. I think they need to have stronger enforcement mechanisms against owners that own these really abysmal condition properties.
A fourth area, Elizabeth, has to do with the issue of public corruption around the tax credit program. And just earlier this month, the Federal District Court in Dallas sentenced a low-income housing tax credit developer to 8 years in federal prison for making bribes to city council members in Dallas. And I think that's all has to do with the point system that the state legislature has put in place, in which city councils must approve a tax credit development in order for that development to get the level of points that it needs to get funded. So in a highly competitive tax credit application cycle, there's tremendous incentives for unscrupulous tax credit developers to offer bribes to local elected officials. It's happened several times in Dallas, and people have been sent to federal prison. And we just had an incident in Houston. And while there is no bribery alleged formally in that issue, there was unseemly prioritization of a tax credit development that produced very few units over other tax credit developments that produced many more units. And the developers had a relationship with the mayor's former law partner. This is another area of controversy around the tax credit program. I know you're especially concerned about a fifth area, which has to do with the long-term affordability of these very costly low-income housing tax credit developments. What's the issue there and what's the state's role?
You know, sometimes we talk about this in the bucket of housing preservation, and what we're talking about is just that there's such a need for housing that's affordable to people with low incomes, and we're putting all these resources into this program. And then on the back end, after typically 30 years, these projects can exit the low-income housing tax credit program and typically go to market rate and are sold to, you know, some kind of market rate owner. John, you're right. That is an area that I care deeply about. And one thing that can happen when these low-income housing tax credit projects kind of age out of the program after usually 30 years, sometimes a little more, is that the rents go up and the tenants will have to move out. So there's a certain short grace period for that. But you see people losing their affordable housing. They're back in the market. And as a society, we are losing all of these units when really the fight is to get more and more low-income units for the growing population and the existing and growing need at extremely low-income and very low-income levels. So this is something that we really care about, and there are a number of mechanisms within TDHCA's control and the state legislature's control through which they can help to preserve this low-income housing tax credit program housing as affordable housing over the long term. And we'd like to see that continue, and that's something we'll keep pushing for.
So next year, we're looking for Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs to use its public hearing process to address these five issues that we've just talked about in the qualified allocation plan that the state uses to award tax credits. And those issues, again, are number one, give tenants a choice of where to live. Don't push them into the worst condition neighborhoods in the city. Two, make sure that the units are as affordable as they can be. Three, that the apartments are well maintained over the long run. Four, that the program doesn't continue to be plagued by this public corruption scandal in its operation. And then finally, that what we do build and invest in the low-income housing tax credit program is available as affordable housing for the longest period of time possible.
Definitely. And this is all more urgent than ever this year, because when we're looking at the federal legislation from appropriations, there's a huge potential that we're going to have a really big increase in low-income housing tax credits across the country, including in Texas. And so it's all the more reason to go ahead and close up some of these problems now as that money comes in.
There's one more issue I want to bring up, Elizabeth, which is, I know, something that both you and I have talked a lot about. I just participated in a process by writing a letter to the city of Lakeway, which is a wealthy exurb of Austin out on Lake Travis, which has very little to no. I think it's true they have no subsidized housing units at all within their city limits. And a developer was proposing to build a low-income housing tax credit development out there and needed a zoning change in order to get approval to do it. In the course of that discussion, the developer and the city council and the whole debate around this housing cast the development as workforce housing. I understand at some level that a developer will create a phrase like that in order to try to appeal to the economic interests of people in the area and to perhaps avoid the word low income in the course of talking about the development because of the racism and classism associated with people who engage in NIMBY attitudes to block those type of projects. But Elizabeth, the term workforce housing just strikes me as really, really wrong. This is homes for people and children and families. This isn't some sort of statist gulag of housing where the workers are forced to live. Oh, how do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I hate the term workforce housing so much for so many reasons. I mean, it's basically a meaningless term. Like everywhere it pops up, it has a completely different definition in terms of what income levels they're talking about. And it's typically implying that people of lower income levels aren't working or something like that. And it's typically used, as you mentioned, in these debates where it's kind of being used in this racist way to cast a picture that this is different from what is imagined to be truly low income housing. It's really problematic in the way it, you know, paints an ugly picture about who might live in low income housing and about why people might be desirous of having any kind of subsidized housing in their community.
Everybody deserves a decent place to live, and everybody deserves an opportunity in life to be successful. And that implies the housing is affordable, the housing is safe, it's a place where your kids can go to a good school. This is so strained from all of that.
Definitely. And, you know, thinking about the Lakeway situation, and, you know, I see that type of news juxtaposed with happy stories about someone providing a plate of turkey to a person in need. And I wish that everyone who you know, would like to provide a plate of turkey to a person in need would instead stand up in their community and say, yes, I'd like you to construct some more housing in my community. I would love for that building to be next to me, and I'll welcome that in. And I'll welcome in the new neighbors that come with it.
One more question, Elizabeth. What's it like to be very often the only person in the hearing room advocating for the interest of tenants when the rest of the room is packed with developers?
Wow, it's honestly pretty disconcerting, but also feels really empowering that we are bringing that side of the coin. You know, you're looking at this whole program, this federal program, tons of money, all these interests at play, and it's really all for the future tenants, and you see no representation of that.
Well, thanks for what you do, Elizabeth, and we'll check back with you in a few months and see how things are progressing in the low-income housing tax credit world.
Sounds good, John. Thanks a lot.
That's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to get involved in learning more about low-income housing tax credits, you can read our blog at texashousing.org or contact Elizabeth. And when you see a development being proposed in your city, it would be great if you would get involved and speak out on the behalf of the housing needs of low-income people. And now JT Hirschmack will take us out with our theme music.